Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. Well, we'll get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Dr. Christina Sporting. Dr. Sporting has been in the dog training and behavior profession for over 20 years. She has a PhD in biopsychology, the study of the biological basis of behavior, and is a certified applied animal behaviorist. She also has a BS in wildlife ecology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is particularly interested in stress, neurobiology, cognition, emotion, and well-being, and how to apply these concepts to the prevention and early intervention of behavior problems in dogs. In addition to working with behavior clients, Dr. Sporting teaches a variety of online courses and webinars on the science of behavior through her website, www.smartdogtrainingandbehavior.com. She also regularly presents on canine behavior science at conferences and other events. In 2019, Dr. Sporting received the Association of Professional Dog Trainers, APDT's Member of the Year Award. She currently serves on the IAABC Foundation Board and the Fair Free Advisory Group. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Dr. Sporting to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Christina, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us at Animal Training Academy.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
And a big shout out to the ripples of the wonderful Veronica Bertelli today for connecting us and making this episode possible. So gratitude to her. Let's dive straight in, eh? Can you take us back, Christina? We love hearing people's behavioral odysseys on this show. That's what we like to call them. So can you please take us back to where you got started? Where did you first learn about behavior, about positive reinforcement, about training, about cognition, about all of these things that we've just learned that you're interested in? And can you share your journey with us?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in animals and animal behavior, and I grew up with dogs, so they were always a big focus of mine because they were right there in my home with me. And I remember from a very, very young age fervently wishing that I could get in their head and communicate with them. And when I was in third grade, we got a new puppy, a standard poodle, and we started taking her to training classes. And I assume my parents participated in the training, but mostly what I remember is that I was the one taking her to class, and you know, they would bring me, but I would train her. And so this would have been the mid to late 80s. And they must have been a pretty progressive school because they did use physical corrections, but they did a lot of food reward too. And so I trained her using those methods. And then several years later, we got a Sheltie. And I remember at one point working with the standard poodle and watching her response to the training methods. And I looked at her and I said, you know what? She doesn't like this. And so I'm going to stop training her. And I think, like, as a kid, I feel like I had the freedom to do that, right? Because I'm under no obligation to have a trained dog. So I just decided, well, she doesn't like training, so I'm not going to train her. And then I focused on the Sheltie. And I kind of I guess I just sort of knew intuitively that using any kind of aversives with him just wasn't going to work. And so I did all positive reinforcement with him. I trained, people in the U.S. probably know what 4-H is. It's like a sort of a, it's like a kids organization, but it's very based on farm animals. It's sort of very rural based, but they had a dog training program and we had a local school. We had moved at this point, so it was a different school. And again, this was outside of Minneapolis, and I know they have a lot of very progressive trainers there. And so for the time period, which by this point was the early 90s, a lot of positive reinforcement, but certainly they were still using a lot of punishment. And I just ignored the punishment and just used positive reinforcement. So really almost from the beginning, that's what I was using. And again, I almost feel like as a kid, I had a little bit more freedom to just sort of, you know, I was a teenager and I thought I knew everything and just do it my own way. And so when I went to college, I knew I was interested in animal behavior. I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and they are a big ag school. And so you didn't just major in biology there. They had maybe 20 different biology-related majors. So I started off in zoology, but I didn't feel like it was quite the right match. And I switched to wildlife ecology, which was more about sort of the whole animal and how they interacted with their environment. I think it was the closest thing to behavior that I could get at that school. And I remember having a conversation with one of my teaching assistants, and he asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, what I really want to do is rehabilitate aggressive dogs. But I know that you can't make any money at that. So instead, I'm going to go into like wildlife management or something like that. And he said, well, actually, there's a professor here that does that. And that was Patricia McConnell. So by total chance, I got hooked up with her. She was an adjunct professor, so she didn't work full time. But she did teach one or two classes there. And so I started as an assistant at her school, and she allowed me to sit in a few times on some of her training sessions. I took her class, and she really provided me with a lot of sort of career support and guidance. And then around that same time, APDT at that time was doing little mini conferences. And so they had a mini conference in Madison, and she spoke at that, and Sue Sternberg spoke at that. I can't remember who else was there. And I remember just being blown away that, oh, I'm not the only person that has chosen not to use these really heavy-handed techniques. And so that's, I think, kind of what got me started, is because I realized that there's other people that are working on these things. And then there was an animal shelter there that I also started volunteering at and then ended up getting hired at. So that also really shaped where I was coming from.
Well, I wasn't expecting you to say Patricia McConnell was going to be the person at the university. I'm curious. There must be some more stories here, and I'm sure our audience would like to hear about what it was like to have Dr. McConnell as a mentor.
Well, she was, it was great. And, you know, we didn't have a ton of interaction because she was just, you know, she was very busy and she had a lot of people that wanted her attention. I think I'd have to look up the date of her first book, but her, you know, she had her like her little sort of how-to books for trainers, but her first real big full-length book, I think, came out right around that time. So I was an assistant for her school, her dog training school, and she was not teaching the classes. So she had other trainers that worked with her. So primarily I learned from them. But obviously she had taught them. And so it was, you know, again, this is now late 90s. And it was all positive reinforcement based. And it gave me a really solid understanding of how to train dogs. And then to be able to sit in with her. I mean, I think the biggest thing she did is just provided me with a role model in terms of this is what I want to do, is I want to do what she's doing. And she really helped guide me in terms of how can I get that PhD and get that education level so that I can do what she's doing. And I know she started, I won't give the details because I might get them wrong, but she started her PhD a little bit later in life. And I remember us having a conversation about that at one point, because I took a break between undergraduate and PhD, and I felt like, oh, I'm so behind, I'm so late. And she's like, oh, no, you're starting earlier than I did. So that's the biggest thing, is just, I think, having a model of where I wanted to go and someone that had succeeded and had like really succeeded. And so that was very valuable to me.
Yeah, I think she's helped guide many people. We actually are approaching episode, at the time of this recording, we're approaching episode 150. At the time of this release, we're 8 episodes past that. But I was curious about what were some of the most downloaded episodes in our show. And out of 150, hers was number 7. So I know she's really resonated.
Yeah. And she's very positive. Yeah, she's been, and she's continued, She's continued to be a mentor and a role model for me since then. So I feel incredibly lucky. And I didn't really seek her out. I didn't know who she was. Like, I didn't know she existed. And he just said, oh, there's this professor at the school. So it just like fell in my lap. I mean, I just can't believe how lucky I was.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said that she helped with in whatever way your decision to do your PhD and guide your focus in that.
Yeah, so I remember talking to her about how do you become a certified applied animal behaviorist, because she is too. And so she helped provide guidance in terms of what I might want to go to graduate school in, and sort of what I wanted to focus on. I think we probably talked about what subjects to pick and things like that. And then just having the opportunity to watch her work and see what she did and know that that was definitely what I was interested in. It was wonderful.
And you did then your PhD in biopsychology. Can you run us through a little bit of information about what your PhD was focused on? And we'd love to hear.
Yeah, so I was... So my PhD advisor was Gordon Gallup. And so some people may know him as the guy that did the red dot research with chimpanzees. So he did the initial studies that showed that chimpanzees were self-aware. And that was back, I think, in the 60s. And so I also got very lucky to have him as an advisor. And his big focus was on the role of evolution in behavior. So I got a lot of training in terms of how does natural selection and evolution shape behavior. When I was there, he was no longer doing research on primates and hadn't been for quite some time, and he was really human focused. And then the rest of the department at that time, almost exclusively the rest of the department, all the professors that were taking on graduate students at that point, because I was his last graduate student, they were all doing neuroscience. So I ended up, so actually in the middle of graduate school, they changed the name of the program from biopsychology to behavioral neuroscience. So I never did lab work in behavioral neuroscience, but I had a lot of coursework in behavior neuroscience, and I had a lot of professors that focused on that. So I also got a lot of training in the brain and behavior and how the brain influences behavior and vice versa. I did a little bit of research on like mere self-recognition in dogs. And so I was sort of trying to get at some self-awareness essentially we tried to do the mirror test in dogs to see if they would recognize themselves in a mirror. There's no evidence of that. But I also think So what you do for that test is you mark, you put a mark on the animal, and you put the mark in a place where they can only see it if they're looking in a mirror, and then you observe their reaction. So when you do that in the chimpanzees, you put them in front of the mirror, they have a red dot on their forehead, and it is very obvious. They will touch the dot, and then they will look at their finger, which is hard to argue. And they don't do that if they're not in front of a mirror, right? So it's very, very obvious that they are recognizing themselves in the mirror. So dogs did none of that. However, I'm really not convinced that they care that there is a mark on them. So even if we marked them where they could see the mark, they paid no attention to it. So they failed the mirror test, but I don't really see that as evidence that that in and of itself is not evidence that they're not self-aware, if that makes sense. That research was never published because it was very clear very early on that there wasn't much there. But we did look into that a little bit.
Awesome. And so you've done your PhD, and what happened after that?
So I got my bachelor's in 2000, and then I didn't go back until 2007. Actually, I think, 2007, I think, is when I started my graduate program. Maybe it was 2008. Anyway, so in the meantime there, I had opened my dog training business. And so I was doing dog training and behavior. And then when I started graduate school, I just couldn't run a business. I had a toddler. So I couldn't be a graduate student, run a business, and be a mom at the same time. So I closed the business temporarily. And then once I was nearing the end of graduate school, I opened the business back up again. So I was doing classes and private training and, behavior work. And then also for several years in graduate school, I was teaching college courses on learning theory and then a variety of other things. But for some reason, while I was there, no one wanted to teach learning theory. And so they just kept giving it to me because I loved teaching it. So I taught it quite a few times in college, and that really helped me learn the material really well. And I also had this incredible opportunity at the school. They had a teaching institute that was free to the students. And so I got a lot of really kind of high level instruction in how to teach. And so then I opened the business back up. We were just doing family dog, basic training classes, which were heavily modeled after Patricia McConnell's structure. And I had really struggled with whether to go back into private training or whether to go into academia. And this was because I loved teaching, and I ended up choosing to go back into private training. And then I just missed teaching so much that I started thinking more and more about doing that again. And I had plans in place to start to do more teaching of professionals. And then COVID hit, and it really accelerated that process because all of a sudden, we weren't doing anything. And eventually we started to do some things online, but it was a lot, it was a lot less busy than I had been. And so at this point, I'm spending more of my time focusing on the classes and courses that I teach than I am the private training.
And somewhere in here, you became a certified applied animal behaviorist. And can you tell us about your certification and the difference between that and someone who might call himself a certified dog trainer?
Yes. Thank you. I forgot about that part of it. Yeah. So that was the whole reason, or a big part of the reason why I wanted to get a PhD, is because I wanted to become a certified applied animal behaviorist. Although I always wanted a PhD, like I was a very, very nerdy student. So I always wanted a PhD ever since I found out what they were when I was in third grade. So a certified applied animal behaviorist is a certification that is awarded through the Animal Behavior Society. And that is Academic Society of Animal Behavior Researchers. And at some point, they decided to do this certifying body for animal behavior. And I don't have, I can actually pull up the requirements, but you have to have, there's two levels. There's the associate certified applied animal behaviorist, and then there's the certified applied animal behaviorist. And you have to have a master's for the associate, and you have to have a PhD for the full CAB. And then, and it has to be a master's or a PhD in the field of animal behavior. And then they also have specific requirements for coursework. So you have to have a certain number of academic credits in things like ethology, animal learning, animal psychology. And in addition to that, you have to have several years of experience either researching or doing applied work with the species in question. So I'm certified for dogs. I couldn't get certified for horses, for example, if that's what I wanted to do. And then they also really strongly recommend having had some kind of mentorship with a existing CAB. I think that covers, and then you have to sort of present a body of work showing that, you know, you've sort of been active in the field. You have to submit several case studies, and then all of that is reviewed by a board of current CABs, and then they either decide to grant you the certification or not.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
is that just available to North American citizens, or is that a worldwide organization?
I believe, and I haven't done my homework on this, so I couldn't tell you for sure. I believe that it's just people in North America. I also think that the UK has their own version that is very, very similar, and I don't remember exactly what the qualifications are for that. That's a good question. I wish I could give you a definite answer on that, but I can only make an educated guess.
It'd be better than my educated guess.
Yeah. I can tell you that most, if not all of us, are in the U.S. I feel like there maybe is somebody in Canada, but I can't remember that for sure. There are certainly people that could answer that question. I just don't know.
You definitely have an interesting odyssey and experience base and learning history to draw from. That's unique. When I think back through all of the guests of our show, and therefore I'm super curious now, because I'm wondering, when a client comes to you with what we might label as a behavior problem with one of their dogs, like, what's your main tools? What's your first questions? Like, what level? Because I can also see your congratulations as well for being the 2019 APDT Member of the Year, serving on the IAABC Foundation Board, Fair Free Advisory Group. So you're in the same conversations as the ACA audience, and you're bringing this really valuable and unique perspective. So how does it share similarities with everyone? And do you see any unique variables that you're kind of considering and you don't see others considering as much?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, so remember, my PhD is in biopsychology, so almost the opposite of the ABA world. Not that they are not, they're not mutually exclusive, right? I mean, they complement each other. They're not, I probably shouldn't use the word opposite because they're not really opposites, but I took a graduate level learning course. It was certainly in there. But the heavy emphasis in my graduate education was on the role of evolution, the role of the brain, the role of hormones, and all of that. And so, and how everything influences each other. And so for me, what I see myself being really interested in is how all of these different systems of the animal work together and interact to produce the ultimate behavior that we see, and then how that behavior then influences all of those systems. So it's very much a two-way street, way more than two ways, really. So when I'm working with clients, I'm really interested, you know, when we're looking at learning theory, we're talking a lot about what is the immediate function of the behavior in terms of what is being reinforced or punished. And obviously, I get that information and I try and look at that as well. But I'm also really interested in all of this other research, particularly stress, and how that is influencing the animal and their behavior and how we can address that. And the role of stress is very profound and far-reaching. And so as I started working with these dogs and getting them when they're already sort of falling to pieces, I became more and more interested in stress and felt more and more like I wasn't seeing it talked about as much as I felt like it should be. And so that's one area where I think I see a difference. And I don't mean lots of people are talking about stress, but I think there are many, many layers to it that I don't see as much. And that's where I started getting really interested is where can we go in the research world that's not dog focused, that has a lot of very in-depth information that we can really benefit from. And so then I started sort of looking into not just stress, but other related things that I felt like we could bring in that would really enhance our ability to work with animals.
Well, I want you on my team. And what I mean when I say that, I said this to you before recording, and I'll say it again on the recording now, and I say it because it resonates with me, and I could be saying it and it resonates with no one else but me, but I'm pretty sure it resonates with others, and that is the dartboard metaphor that Susan Friedman offers, where we are the same in so much as you're on my dartboard. My focus is ABA and the bullseye there, but I want you on my team because I want a strong, solid dartboard, and I know that I can't help a lot of animals or clients or whoever I'm working with without that full picture. So I'm interpreting from what you're saying, ABA is on your dartboard, but it's not your bullseye. And so is stress your bullseye, or would you call it something else?
So I think I would I would probably call it ethology. So ethology is the study of animals sort of in their natural environment. So most of the learning research that's been done it's been done on a variety of species, but the vast majority of it is done on rodents and pigeons in the lab. And we have gained huge amounts of incredibly valuable information from that research, but it's only one picture. But sometimes I think of it as sort of like having a microscope or binoculars, depending on what direction you want to go in, where the lens is sort of clouded over. And so you get this really clear picture of one part of the whole story, but the rest of it is missing. It's not there. And so to me, I think ethology can bring in all of that other stuff. And the study of ethology includes learning, and it includes all of these other things as well, like, you know, domestication and social behavior and emotion and cognition and perception and I don't know if I already said this, but the impact of natural selection on behavior and how these adaptive processes influence behavior and what the function of behavior is, not just in that immediate moment, but why did it evolve and why does that exist in the species as a whole? And so that's what I would say my bullseye is. It's a pretty big, broad picture, but it's really looking at why do animals behave the way they do from an adaptive standpoint? How does this behavior help them survive? It's very related to reinforcement and punishment, but it's a little bit bigger picture.
And it's something that I'm consistently aware of, and why I want you on my team, or other species specialists, I'm going to say, on my team, especially when working with exotic teams. I come in with my level of analysis, and then I try to invite people smarter than I to basically come in as well. And someone comes in with way more subject matter expertise on the species we're working with, and I just sit down and shut up. Just like what
well,
they said.
Yeah, but you know what? I think that dialogue between the sort of academics, the academics and the researchers and the people that are on the ground doing the hands-on work with the animals is critical. And I think if we don't have that, we'll just have these sort of parallel trajectories that don't attain the same level of knowledge and understanding as we would talking to each other. And so I think that's something that's really helped me, is that I have had both of those things, because I did dog training for a long time before I went back and got my PhD. Although I will say, I considered myself pretty well educated as a dog trainer, and I still, when I went to graduate school, my mind was blown by how much I didn't know. And I don't mean to say, I mean, it's just, there's so much, but I think it also depends on, like you said, where do you want your bullseye to be? Because I could learn a lot more about the mechanical training skills. That is not my strength. My strength is the academic stuff, but that's why I want to have these conversations like I'm having with you and, you know, your listeners, is so that we can have this dialogue and we can take both of our sources of knowledge, which are both, I think, equally valuable, and talk to each other and make them even better.
Yeah, to borrow from Dr. Freeman, she says we should keep our sister sciences close, and they should keep us close. And I think, you know, the work that Susan's doing with Dr. Chrissy Alligood from Disney Animal Kingdom, and that new offering, How Research Works, and that those positions in organisations where you have exotic species, filtering that research down into the hands-on stuff is a really exciting area that I invite lots and lots of conversations about. But looking at the time, it's probably one of the most common things that Ryan says in these podcast episodes. Let's express gratitude to you for sharing all of that so far with us and your learning odyssey. That was really interesting to talk about. Moving forward, though, you've put a list together for us of five areas of research, current research, that you feel can really add to our field as professional trainers. So let's waste no more time. Let's make Ryan stop talking and dive straight in. What is number one?
So number one is stress and resilience. So I always come back to stress. I like to say stress is everything, which it's not, but it, you know, it's just so impactful. So when animals, I mean, I could talk about stress for the entire time, so I'll try and scale it down a little bit. But when animals experience stress during development, it literally changes the brain, so that their brain looks different than animals that don't experience stress during development. And so they end up having, you know, being sort of more susceptible to stress learning. It's harder for them, to fear learning. It's harder for them to unlearn fear once they do develop it. And it impacts how they learn, and it impacts their social behavior. You know, obviously, like, early development matters. I think probably most people know that. What mom goes through while she's pregnant matters. And it turns out, and I didn't realize this until I really started looking into the stress research, but adolescents are also incredibly vulnerable to stress. which, having an adolescent during COVID, I now have lived it. But I think sometimes I think we focus so much on puppies. And, you know, again, I don't know the other species as well, so I don't know if there's the same kind of emphasis in the other species, but I think we forget that the adolescents are still really vulnerable. And then the other thing that happens during adolescence is that stress that those animals have experienced previously in life that may not have shown up yet suddenly starts to impact their behavior in adolescence. So not only are they more vulnerable to stress in the moment, but now the old stuff is like catching up to them and it's starting to impact their behavior. And then the other thing that stress does is it chronic stress. Like, I mean, we're talking, again, I'm simplifying things a little bit, but some stress is good. So we're talking about stress that exceeds an animal's ability to cope, or stress that's occurring over a long period of time. But they, you know, that chronic stress also throws most or all of the other body systems into sort of dysregulation and chaos. And at least there's been very little research on this in dogs, but in many other mammals, it creates all kinds of health issues, and like reproductive issues, growth issues, gastrointestinal issues, and even like reduces the lifespan of the animal. So stress is huge.
And is that all tied into epigenetics?
Yeah, well, not all. Some of it is. Yeah. So we know, like, for example, maternal care impacts. So babies that have good moms essentially seem to be more stress resilient than those that don't. And there's evidence that that actually changes the epigenetics of the animal. And in fact, this is only one study, so we have to take it with a grain of salt, but there was a study by Diaz and Ressler in 2014. Do you know about this study? Okay. So they took mice, I think, and they taught the males to be afraid of a particular odor. And then they bred the males, and they looked at the offspring, and they found out that the offspring, even though they never interacted with dad, were also afraid of that particular odor. And it turns out that there had been sort of changes in the brain that they think were caused by epigenetic changes that dad experienced. So, and we know, like, trauma, for example, we're just getting more and more evidence that things that adults experience in their lifetime can change the expression of genes that then gets passed on to offspring. And so that sort of leads to these, like, multi-generational, like, effects of trauma that is probably true in dogs, just like it is in people.
Well, the implications of that are pretty significant.
Yeah. I mean, it's huge. That's why I say stress is everything, because I mean, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, right? Like, obviously, stress is not the only thing that matters, but it matters a lot. And so if we can understand the impacts of stress and how to address them, then I think that that can really increase our ability to help animals.
So as a professional on the ground, what is something we can do to help understand this and to take action?
So, well, obviously educating ourselves as much as we possibly can about stress. And then, like, we don't know a whole lot about stress resilience, but we do know some things. And so, for example, there's some research that suggests that teaching animals to work for reinforcers may increase their ability to cope with stress. So there's this really cool study that was done in rats that I wrote up on my blog a month or two ago, where they buried Fruit Loop cereal in bedding, and then one group of rats had to work to find it. And they started off really easy, and then they progressively made it harder. And then the control group, it was just sort of scattered around their cage, so they didn't really have to work to get it. And it seems like the ones that had to work harder had more stress resilience later on. And so really simple things, you know, like, you know, giving our dogs challenges, none of this applies to just dogs, by the way. I just say dogs because that's the species that I work with. But, you know, giving them challenges that they can succeed at. So not too hard, but also not only giving them really easy things. And then exercise increases the ability to cope with stress, enrichment, species typical. I mean, here's zoo, you know, background. So I'm sure, you know, you're familiar with the idea of species typical enrichment. And actually a lot of this research on enrichment comes out of the zoo world. Most of the research comes out of the zoo world. Some of it's in labs, but, and then social support helps, and control, which is actually one of the other things on my list of the research that we would benefit from.
Well, how about we talk about that then as number two, and maybe that's going to completely throw you, but let's talk about control.
Choice and control are two other things that I think are really valuable. And again, I mean, I think it's not that we're not talking about this stuff at all in the animal training world, but there's so much depth to it that I think really enhances our ability to use it. So with choice and control, we know that adding control really improves an animal's ability to cope with stress very dramatically. So I don't know if you want me to go into the background of some of this, because it's very unpleasant research, the learned helplessness research. Okay. So the learned helplessness research was done in the 60s. And what they did is they sort of strapped dogs into a cage, basically immobilized them, and then they would play a tone, and then they would shock the dogs. And they did this repeatedly. And then they put the dogs in a different enclosure, and they would play the tone. And what they expected to happen was that the dogs would learn to move from one side of the cage to the other to avoid the tone. But that's not what happened at all. Instead, they just stayed there. Although very interestingly, there was a small percentage of dogs that did learn to escape. And I've never seen anything looking at why did those dogs, like what was special about them that they didn't have this effect. But that's learned helplessness. For those of you that are familiar with learned helplessness, and the idea is that when an animal does not have control, it becomes this generalized concept of helplessness. And in people, scientists believe that that's a really strong component of depression, is that people that are depressed have developed some degree of learned helplessness. So that was what first sort of gave scientists a heads up that there's something going on here. And then this caused all of this other research. So two things I want to say about that. One is we now know that when you add control into a scenario, we have a really good understanding of what happens in the brain when you add control. And again, to simplify it, what ends up happening is sort of this chain of events that ends up with the amygdala being inhibited. So the amygdala is that fear circuit in the brain. So when you add in control, it actually shuts down the amygdala so that the animal is less afraid. And that's in the brain. Like we can kind of track the pathway of what's going on there. And also if you add in control enough, and then the animal is put in a situation where they don't have control, the brain responds as if they do have control. And again, that's why we think that there's this resiliency component to control, because even when the animal doesn't have control, the brain is like acting as if they do, and that makes it less stressful. And then there's also a model out there. There's a couple different scientists that have talked about this, but the paper that I'm most familiar with is Moscarello and Hartley. And they've put this really interesting model out about how animals make estimates of agency. So when they go into a new environment, they kind of make an educated guess about how much control they have. And if they think they have a lot of control, they tend to behave more proactively. So they engage in more problem-solving behavior, they're more exploratory in their environment, and their behavior is more sort of goal-directed or kind of like intentional or cognitively controlled. If they don't think they have a lot of control, they tend to behave very reactively, which in this context means more defensive behavior, more, you know, sort of freezing and less exploration and more sort of habitual behavior that's, again, just sort of very reactive to the environment. And so it's two very different pictures of behavior simply based on that animal's previous experience with control.
What it's making me think of is as a practical applier teaching our learners, our non-human learners, a variety of behaviors and generalizing them across contexts and teaching them how to access reinforcers would help with all of the things.
Yeah, yes, and we have evidence for that too. That teaching them that they have control over whether or not they get reinforcers also helps them cope better with stress.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. That was all super interesting. And I think people are going to be exploring that research about animals making estimates of agency. I know it's going to be on my mind as I watch my animals over the next couple of days.
I'm like, yeah.
Figuring out how much agency they have right now.
Yeah, it's really exciting stuff.
What's number three, Christina?
So ethology, which honestly encompasses all of these things, but I really wanted to put it down as its own thing because I do think it's so important. And it's just a different way, it's just a different lens for looking at animal behavior. And so, and again, this is a huge topic that I could spend a lot of time talking about, but I think one of the best ways to illustrate it is to talk about the aggression model. So when we talk about aggression in most animal training and behavior, we tend to be really sort of describing a behavior, right? So aggression is growling, barking, you know, snarling, biting, for example. In ethology, they really present it more as sort of what is the function of this behavior, and not from a reinforcement perspective, but from an adaptive perspective. So, and this isn't 100% consistent because there's different ways of looking at the same thing. But one of the really common models that you see of aggression is that you have, so conflict behavior in general is agonistic behavior. And then that is divided into different categories. So usually what ethologists are talking about when they're talking about aggression is competition over resources, which is very specific. And the reason that I think this is a worthwhile distinction to make is because the other form of agonistic behavior is defensive behavior. And those are two different things. And so if you're talking about a dog that is showing growling, snarling, snapping, biting over resources, it is not necessarily the same thing as a dog that's showing growling, snarling, snapping, biting because they feel threatened. And my suspicion is that if we start to really look at those two behaviors as if they're two different things, that is probably going to open a lot of doors in terms of why does this method work so well for some dogs and it doesn't work for other dogs. My guess is it's going to help us deal with those cases of what we're now broadly calling aggression that don't really respond very well to behavior modification because it, and sometimes they think it's pathological. Like sometimes they think that there's something that isn't functioning correctly in that dog because a lot of, you know, again, from the ethological perspective, aggression is normal. It's like, it's conflict reducing behavior, honestly. Like, a lot of aggression over resources is very ritualized. And so, and the whole point of it is to decrease actual fights and injury. So sometimes it's pathological, and that's a different story. You know, that means there's something, there's some kind of brain or medical thing that's causing abnormal behavior. But I think a lot of aggression is normal behavior. And I think if we added in some of that ethology research, that it would give us a broader way of looking at what we all lump into one big category right now, that may help us draw more tools in terms of how to deal with snapping, snarling, biting, you know, growling type behaviors.
And so it's challenging, I think, sometimes when you have your bullseye to listen. And I could just end the sentence there. Because how do you listen to something and not put it through the filter? You know what I mean? So if you were to hear aggression, you know, your ABA trained brain, and this is something that I've talked about with lots of guests on this show, because I think, you know, even if we're reading, say, popular psychology and we're reading the growth mindset, like, which we've done in our animal training academy community, but and when we started reading it, the questions were like, but what does that look like? what does the growth mindset look like? What are the antecedents? Where are the reinforcers? And then, so I like to learn ways to, you know, I don't want to say switch hats. Like, let's take my ABA hat off and put my ethology hat on, because that's not personally, I think, what I want this show to represent. I'm like, let's build our team. Like, we can focus on ABA, but we've also got Dr. Sporting here when we have those questions. But this is a question, but I haven't asked a question. Like, just offer input on what I've said, maybe.
Well, you know, I think it's layers, right? So I think, like, what I'm saying, like, I'm not saying that, and I don't know if this is how it came across or not, but I'm not saying that we need to throw out, like, the ABA model and replace it with ethology. I think that it just broadened our perspective. And I certainly, like, I still think that aggressive behavior is reinforced. Like, there is still, if I mean, we didn't really get into it in this podcast, but if you look at ethology, there's these four questions in ethology. And one of them does relate to sort of, why is this behavior happening in the moment? And so, but then it's also sort of looking at, are the underlying processes that are sort of happening in the body different in certain dogs than others? So, for example, this might be a clearer example, I don't know, but we know that there are two different stress profiles in animals. And some of them have this really strong adrenaline response, and then a more muted release of stress hormones. And then others have, they don't have as much of an adrenaline response, but then they have this really reactive release of stress hormones, where they're releasing a lot of stress hormones. And so you have literally two different physiological profiles in the animal. And so if that's the case, these animals that are sort of have this more reactive stress profile may need to be worked with differently than the ones that have this different physiological profile. And so if we, and I mean, we don't have enough information right now to be able to say this dog has this profile and this one doesn't. But if we could get that information through continued research, it may allow us to fine tune the techniques that we're already using to get better results, especially in those dogs that don't react all that well to what we're doing. And I don't, I mean, I hope I'm not giving the impression that I'm saying those methods don't work. They do work, but we all know that there's some dogs that don't respond as well as others. And so my hope is that by bringing in some of this additional information, that may give us new insights into why isn't it working in these dogs, and what else might we be able to try. I don't know if that addresses some of the sort of thoughts and questions you were having, but
yeah, it's when as say a dog trainer or whatever species you're working with, exotic trainer, zoo, horse trainer, we come across one of those individuals who the strategies don't seem to be working as well with, then we can reach out to you and get these different perspectives. But the question also comes like how do we create that mindset? For example, we're reading some ethology and we're reading as a dog trainer and we're reading about alpha primates, and then we've got this like trigger to be like there's this conflict between our learning history with that word, but like not, but it might make us miss the value and the research of primates and ethology. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Am I making any sense?
I think what you're kind of talking about is, I mean, I don't know, but like there is a bit of a friction. There was, so I think for the most part that friction is gone within academia. I mean, it's kind of there, but there used to be a huge friction. And now I think both sides, again, within academia, have sort of like, oh, yeah, it's all, it's not all the same, but it's all real and applicable and valid. And so I think for me, in terms of sort of getting around that mindset, is not thinking of it where, oh, I have to throw this out. This is wrong. This learning theory, reinforcement, punishment, ABA stuff is wrong, and so I need to bring in this stuff instead. It's more like, what else can I learn to enhance what I already know that is already valuable and correct? So it's not, you know, I talk a lot about ethology. That's the thing that, like, I love and I'm really interested in, but I also love learning theory, and I think it's all applicable. And I think in terms of like hot button topics like dominance, dominance is just incredibly complex and complicated. And so trying to distill it down into like one thing, I mean, it's really actually not even all that well understood, I would say. And I'm talking about dominance in general, not necessarily specific to dogs. And the other thing to understand about dominance is one thing we do know about dominance is that humans are very hierarchical and very focused on power. And so, and some of that is going to vary with culture, right? But so that's our perhaps unconscious filter in terms of when we're working with dogs and, you know, how much of that are we putting on dogs that's based on our biology, and how much of that is really something that is there. But I don't think it's about ABA is wrong or learning theory is wrong or ethology is wrong. It's all valid. And like you said, having that conversation, I mean, just sort of bringing it all in, but no one can focus on everything, right? So I understand learning theory, but there are definitely aspects of ABA that I'm not familiar with, that I'm not very well educated in. And I'm okay with that because I know I can't do it all, right? And so that's why we want to have these conversations so that we can share what we know with each other. And then, you know, people choose their own things to focus on within that.
What's number four? Thank you for all of that, by the way.
You're welcome. So number four actually is the research that is starting to be done on training methods. And a lot of this is very learning theory focused. And it's really only just starting, but there is starting to get to be more applied research that directly applies to animal training. There's a lot of horse stuff out there, which I don't totally keep up with, but I see it as I'm looking for dog studies. So that's really cool to see. There's a very small amount of cats. And I almost never see birds, but maybe it's just in different journals, but there's a lot of horse stuff and there's a lot of dog stuff. And, you know, doing things like studying clicker training and studying different applied things like looking at impulsivity and how that relates to behavior issues in dogs, which researchers have only just started to look at, but there's starting to be a lot more applied work that you can, that trainers are going to be able to look at and say, oh, that very obviously applies to what I do. And there's not a lot of sort of thinking and dancing around to figure out how to fit it into what we're already doing. So these other things I've been talking about totally relate, but I think it requires a little bit more brain power to see how they relate and how you can use them. But these training studies are very concrete. So like, you're probably aware of the clicker studies that have been coming out. There was just one that was done on doing clicker training with 100% food reinforcement versus only 60% food reinforcement. So do you treat after every click, or do you only treat after some of the clicks? And so that found that the rate of learning was the same in both groups, but the dogs that only got treats 60% of the time seem to have more of like a negative emotional state, just a little bit. But it's one study, but that suggests that even though both seemed to be equally effective, that maybe, you know, not reinforcing for every click causes a negative emotional state in the dog. And it's that kind of fine-grained information about training techniques that I think has the potential to really be incredibly valuable, because that kind of research can accelerate the field much, much faster than just trying things on our own and then sharing it with each other, which is also really important.
Thanks. And number five.
Number five actually goes back to stress. And that is the PTSD research that's being done right now. And so PTSD being post-traumatic stress disorder. And we could also have a really long conversation about whether or not animals get post-traumatic stress disorder. What I will say, I'm just going to sort of sidestep the conversation about diagnosis and say that they have a lot of similar symptoms to trauma. It can. So not all animals who experience trauma have long-term effects. But when they do, the symptoms, there's a lot of similarities in the symptoms between non-human animals and humans. So given that, there's a lot of research going on PTSD right now in terms of how it impacts the brain and how broad the effects of trauma can be, as well as how to treat it. And a lot of the treatments are not quite here yet, but it's a very active area of research. And I think that that potentially has the power, especially in the next couple of decades, to really transform our ability to help dogs that are experiencing a lot of sort of global fear and anxiety. And a lot of it has to do with deficits and extinction, and that individuals with PTSD don't seem to extinguish fear as well as other animals, and sort of ways at trying to address that more effectively than maybe what we're doing now.
Awesome. I think I know there's been conversations about that within our ATA membership community, as well as a lot of the other things we've talked about today. So I hope that what this episode's done for you, the listener, is tweaked your curiosity. And if you are a long-time listener of the show, then I know that's in your mindset to be tweaked. So we'll link to some of the stuff we've talked about today, and we're excited to continue the conversations about all of these areas of research. I'm gonna go through the five you've shared with us, so you can tell me if I've been a good listener or not. Number one is stress and resilience. Number two was choice and control. Number three was ethology.
Yes.
Number four, the research starting to be done on learning theory. Number five, PTSD-related research.
Yes.
Dr. Sporting's five areas of research to pay attention to. I don't have a very good voice that would work on advertisement. Hey, thanks so much for all of that, Dr. Sporting. Sure. Sadly, we are now at the final question for this episode. I'm so curious to hear what your answer is to this question that we ask all of our guests. But would like to invite you now to take us into the future and share with us what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in our community, in our animal training world.
Yeah, so this will probably come as no surprise to the listeners at this point. But really, I would love to see more of a sort of a dialogue between trainers and researchers. And when I say dialogue, I kind of mean that in two ways. So one thing that I mean is just for trainers to become more familiar with and more up to date on the research in animal behavior that's going on. And no one is going to be able to keep up with all of it. So please don't try and put that pressure on yourself, because this is what I do and I can't keep up with all of it. So, you know, what I do is I follow the things that I'm most interested in. And then I get really in depth on those and get a really strong knowledge on those. And then, you know, you sort of specialize in those things. So you certainly have the ability to follow the things that you're most interested in. So that's one thing, but I also literally mean a dialogue. I mean, I think I would love to see trainers and researchers talking to each other and talking about what are you seeing on the ground? You know, here's this research study that was done, and what does this mean to you? How do you apply this? What insights does this give you? And then having those conversations go back and influence the research that's being done. And citizen science, I think, is really, I think, could have the ability to have some answer some really important questions as well, in terms of having trainers and or owners go out and start to try and get at some of these really applied questions, like, you know, things like, are there, you know, differences in learning between dogs that are puppies that are raised in shelters versus puppies that come from the breeder? Or are there, you know, what kind of role does impulsivity play in aggression? And if it does play a role in aggression, does working on impulse control help decrease that aggression? Things like that, that I think are much more likely to get answered and answered well if there's a conversation happening between the people who are actually working with the animals and the people who are doing the research. So that's what I would like to see. I don't know how much that's going to happen, but I think that would be fantastic.
So two questions. When you say citizen science, what do you mean? And in your personal opinion, where is the best space for this to happen? Where is the space where these people are coming together, or do you see there being a space for these two communities to come together?
So, yeah, I said citizen science before, but probably what I really should have said was community science. It's just a little bit more of an inclusive term. But basically what it is with community science, studies are designed by trained scientists and the data is analyzed by trained scientists, but the people actually gathering the data are non-scientists. And so in the case of dogs, for example, that might be dog owners, dog trainers, shelter staff, for example. And the benefit of that is it allows us to get a much larger sample than we would be able to get otherwise. So probably the best known example in the United States is Project Feeder Watch, which is run by Cornell University. And what they do is participants can pay a small fee each year. And what they do is they count birds at their feeders, and then they report that back to Cornell along with some information about primarily weather-related data. And then the researchers at Cornell take that and they analyze it. And so they get all kinds of great information about population trends in birds in the United States. There are people doing this all over the country, as well as in Canada, I believe. And so obviously that allows the scientists to get data, you know, a much larger pool of data than they would have otherwise. And in terms of the platform, I am on the board of the IAABC Foundation, which is a newly formed nonprofit. It is associated, we work in partnership with the IAABC, but we are two separate organizations. And part of our mission is to promote education and research. And so we're actually already doing some community science, but we would like to do more. And I think that that is a perfect platform for both the community science as well as this increased dialogue potentially between trainers and scientists. The foundation itself is relatively new and we're just getting started. So I don't have any more specific details than that, but that is certainly one place where we are hoping to do some of that kind of work. And then for me, just personally, I also have a number of ideas that have been swirling around in my head regarding increasing that dialogue between researchers and trainers. But at this point, everything is just at the thinking stage. So again, I apologize, I don't have any details, but the implementation of that will hopefully be coming in the not too distant future.
We didn't mention this at the start, and I'm sorry I haven't asked you this yet, but where can people go online? Oh, we did say it in your bio, but where can people go online? If you can let us know again to find you, social media, where are the best places to find Dr. Sporting online?
Yeah, so my website is www.smartdogtrainingandbehavior.com, and there is a new website coming in the future. But right now, that website is my private training as well as my professional courses. So if you want those professional courses, there's a tab that says professional courses. And then my courses are up there. And then I also have a monthly webinar that looks at a different research article each month, which means you guys don't have to do the work. And I do it for you. And then on Facebook, I'm at Christina Spaulding, PhD, CAB, C-A-A-B.
Awesome. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just saying that's it for social media. I'm not all over social media. I'm going to add Instagram once I get the new website up and running. But
Instagram is where it's at, and we've got to see you on TikTok. No, I'm just joking. Hey. Well, apparently we do. I don't know. I haven't used TikTok myself, but look forward to seeing you on Instagram. We will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes as well. Hey, Christina, this has been so much fun from myself and on behalf of everyone listening. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show with us today. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.